From Bondi Beach to the world. Streaming to all time zones at bondi-tunes.com. This is the world famous Bondi Tunes.
This is Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting on FM in Australia and New Zealand and around the globe. I'm joined by my good friends in Tasmania, Joe and Paul Voter from The Sign, the band The Sign, THESIGN.com. Go there. They have fantastic music. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Henry.
Good to be here.
I was just thinking to myself, and this doesn't happen very often.
Dangerous.
It could be. A lot of our listeners are in Europe and North America, and I'm just thinking, you know, with the skies being open again and people flying around the world again, they may want to come to Australia. Can you give them a good reason why they should go to your beautiful island of Tasmania? Sell this to our listeners.
Wow.
It's cheese. There's cheese, there's truffles, there's wine. Some of the best wine in the world now, some of the best whiskey in the world.
Yeah. Mm.
We have chocolates.
Some of the best cheese.
We have great seafood. We have probably some of the finer dining experiences in Australia.
Clean air.
Really clean air.
Beautiful lakes and rivers.
You can still fish for a couple of months. Well, and then you won't be able to fish because they let the fish spawn. So I think till about June.
Best trout fishing in the world.
Yeah, best trout fishing
aside from New Zealand.
You know, I think about, you know, I've driven myself and the girlfriend have driven around that island. And a couple of things that I would say is that it's beautiful. I mean, I looked, you know, looking at the lakes and the sea, it just looks kind of silver. It's just such a beautiful look. And also, Tasmania doesn't get as hot. Correct me if I'm wrong. I know it does get hot, but by Australian terms, you know, you could go to Perth or even here to Sydney, which is extremely humid in summertime. It is a bit easier on the heat, isn't it?
Oh, way better.
Oh, yes, way nicer. It has been humid the last couple of weeks, which is very high humidity for us, which is unusual.
Well, but that would be all the floods that are going on in La Nina.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. It is. We don't normally get as much humidity. We didn't have much for summer this year.
I know. You know? Neither did we.
Well, they show the weather maps on the news, you know, like red is like really hot and blue or yellow is really cool. When the rest of Australia is really red, we're kind of bluish. So,
which is a good thing. Talking of the floods, people will be aware, obviously, the east coast of Australia has been slammed. And, of course, you're underneath Melbourne. I don't think that part of the country really got affected at all by the floods. Am I correct in that?
Yes, yeah, you are.
We really didn't get drowned. We're in for a few days of rain now, I think, but we've been lucky this time. But I think a couple of years ago, Hobart sort of sunk under lots of flooding, and we have been lucky this time. Actually, we haven't really flooded. The rivers came up, and it was probably a little bit more intense up north, but we didn't get cut off, and there weren't, you know, we didn't suffer what the mainland has suffered, which has been dreadful.
When you guys live in an island paradise, where do you go for holidays? I know that you have been traveling around the world.
The continent.
The continent?
Yes, we go to the continent.
Is that our continent?
We go to the big island.
We don't really go on holidays.
No, we generally tend to go to Japan or the U.S.,
It's working, isn't it? Yeah.
It was working, but
it was cheaper to go to Japan than what it was to fly to Perth internally. Mm.
That's crazy, isn't it? Of course, Japan is quite an expensive country, is it fair to say?
But the airfares were really cheap.
I don't think it's
not
expensive,
as dear
really
as everyone thinks it is.
You pay for we eat a lot of sushi, so, you know, here you're going to pay $4.50 to $5.50 for a plate of sushi. In there, over there, it's a dollar, our dollar, right? Right.
And, of course, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because, you know, I've got a friend who would go over there twice a year before COVID, and he absolutely loves Japan. Mm. And he... he said it's a myth that it's so expensive. You just need to know how to do it.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That's right. I mean, we got like a I don't know what they call them in Sydney, but it's a Mikey card, I think, in Melbourne. But we just got our Suka cards. We got very lucky. The first time we went on tour, we stayed in a house that has Australians in it that have been there for 10 or 12 years.
This is in Japan.
Yeah, in Tokyo. And so what happened was that they showed us, they basically got us a phone, they got us hooked up with a mobile, they got us hooked up with a Suka card.
Which is a train card.
Which is your train card with the JR line. Yeah. So it's the same as having a Mikey card or, you know, your train ticket, your train card.
Yeah, we call it Opal.
Opal, yeah. Uh-huh. So, yeah, but the Suka card is like, it's magical, and now they've hooked it up all the way across. It used to only work, you get one for basically Tokyo,
yeah. Mm.
And now they've actually opened the whole country, I think, to Suka cards, so you can actually travel even to the fast trains, which we never do. We always do local trains. We've learnt now we take local trains.
You take express trains, and they're pretty quick, but they're cheap. The trains are cheap. There's no reason to even – you wouldn't even want to drive a car.
You wouldn't drive there.
You wouldn't drive them, unless maybe if you were going from Tokyo to Osaka.
Osaka,
Or somewhere, you know, where you got to – And even then, it's probably better off to take the fast train. You're there a lot quicker. You don't have to deal with traffic.
Internal flights are not too bad, but I mean, you know, compared to Tassie, hotels are cheaper.
They're $100 a night for a room. Mind you, it's a small room. Enough.
They always are in Japan, aren't they?
Yeah, but you know, for $100, or it's not expensive.
No.
I mean, you can spend a lot of money if you want to go to the best restaurants and you want to stay at the best hotels. You could spend thousands, but, you know, if that doesn't matter to you, boy, you get away pretty cheap.
Yeah, well, we tend to, you know, well, obviously, because we're a band and we're not making any money and we're fairly poor most of the time. That's how we travel, you know.
We have friends that we stay with, so we don't have
to. Tell me about your audience in Japan. I mean, you know, I watched a movie, it must be 10 years ago. What the hell was it called? It's gone completely out of my mind, about a guy in Japan. Anyway. Oh, I can't remember the name.
It was A Guy in Japan.
Oh, maybe that. I don't know. Anyway, the thing is, what you know, you're a band. Obviously, you're there to do gigs. What demographic and where do you go? Because in this movie, I saw, you know, bands playing on the top of hotels, like on the top floor, and they're a bit crazy like that. What kind of gigs did you do, and where did you do them?
We play mainly local. We play live houses, and there's actually some Irish bars there. It's quite interesting, and a guy's got a Scottish bar. He's a Scotsman. He's got a really nice bar there called What the Dickens. And there's a few. It's interesting because they really took to Irish type pubs and food.
Mm.
So it's a funny mishmash. We normally play live houses. We have a friend there who's a promoter who owns three live houses, and that's basically playing on the ground with Japanese bands.
Yeah, they're usually five bands on the night. Yeah.
And is it good money for you guys?
Not really, we sell merch.
We sell merchandise, so that's really good.
Merch is good.
Generally what happens is it costs the locals roughly, it's 2,000 yen, so it's like $200.
I just want to let you know that the movie I was thinking of was Lost in Translation. So our listeners would be screaming at me going, it's Lost in Translation. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh my God! You must see that. It's all about Tokyo, crazy, crazy town.
All right.
Oops.
Oh, wait a minute. 20,000 yen. It's $200.
It's $200. So it's 20,000 yen.
Is what the bands have to pay, and then they it costs 10,000 yen to get in the door.
No, it doesn't. No, $10.
It costs 2,000. No,
2,500. 2,500 yen, Paulie.
Yeah, 2,500.
25. Bucks.
Yeah, rightio. If you get 10 people, if you get 10 people, you've covered your cost. Whatever you make after 10 people, they split with you split with the live house.
Yeah.
But it doesn't cost us because we're guests. So whatever.
Do you get like free, like you can get a hotel room for free in this or?
No, we've just got to the point. It takes about 5 years to build a relationship in Japan, and you have to show that you want to, you keep coming back. Mm-hmm. And they really respect that. So we now are at the point where we actually have places to stay. We, you know, we get accommodated. We get quite well looked after now. Mm. But we did pay for hotels, I think. The first time we went, we paid for hotels. Second time we went on tour with a Japanese guy who put us up in a place for 6 weeks. Mm. Because if you're there a month, you can actually – now you can do Airbnb, but Japan's a little bit odd with this sort of stuff. They prefer you to be there and you rent for a month.
Yeah. Way to go.
Yeah, you rent for a month. And
it's really reasonable.
And it's very reasonable. And you generally get, you know, they'll send someone to do the house cleaning for you once a week. You know, they come in, clean the place, and it's pretty cool, actually. It's way better than a hotel.
It sounds very reasonably priced as well. You know, with this pandemic, which has been going on for the best of 2 years, you haven't been able to go anywhere, really. Now, have things changed for you? Have you planned dates to go overseas? Because I know that you mentioned earlier on that you also work in America.
Yeah.
What's the story with – how do you plan out 2022? Do you see yourself traveling for work again?
Not this year.
Mate, look, if something came up towards the end of 2022 in the UK, maybe like September.
Yeah, September. We get there for Jacktoberfest in
that
Scotland.
Would be fun. We like Scotland, but – at this point in time, I'd sort of made my mind up we were going back 2023 because I figured the world might be a little bit more sane by then. But guess who guessed wrong?
I actually
thought this war was going to happen at Christmas time, so it's a bit late. It's a bit like the seasons, really. So now I'm sort of like going, well, we will probably go back. I think Japan will probably – look, I'd like to do what I organised the last time before this damn virus hit. We were going to do the US, the UK, and hit Japan on the way home. So stay out for about 6 weeks and actually do the whole lot. But we'll see what happens because I've got friends who were going in July and they were going to Europe. I don't know what's going to happen now, whether they're still going. Or whether they're going to sort of like, maybe it's going to spill over, maybe we shouldn't go. I don't know. You know, like some bands are already traveling. I'm kind of hedging my bets. So far I've called it right. I called it right for Tassie. I didn't book anything for January and February because all the gigs got cancelled anyway.
Yeah.
So I was kind of ahead of the game. We've just started booking again now, but that's not to say that it won't all go west again. But that's what you've got to, you know, we're living with it. Europe's opened everything. England's open. Everybody's sort of like going, okay, we've got to live with this. And, you know, we'll just get on with it. But obviously musical venues are more problematical because you're close. That's in Japan, that's a problem with a live house because they're very small.
Yeah.
Everybody wears masks anyway.
Everybody masks when they're sick.
Well, they do, don't they? It's like China. Yeah. They just wear masks anyway.
I mean, it's very respectful. Trying to get them to mask when they're not sick is hard. That's where they read a cultural problem.
So interesting. Now, we've got about 7 minutes left on this. I just want to ask you, there's a federal election coming up in Australia. Just how excited are you about this, guys?
Let me think about that. Henry, well, I think... it would be a very wise thing to possibly have a change of government, you know. But the thing is, nobody wants to do that while we've still got all this stuff going on. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be close. And I, you know, look, I.
Who do you want in, Beelzebub or Lucifer?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. It's the lesser of the evils. And just to let our listeners know, the latest poll, I think it was an Ipsos poll in Australia. The Labour leader and the ruling Liberal Party leader, Scott Morrison and Albo, is Albanese is the Labour leader. They're neck and neck for personal popularity, which has never happened before. And Labour are 10 points ahead of the ruling Liberal Party in Australia. So it seems to me that it's kind of almost a done deal. I know a week is a long time in politics, but I don't know how Scott Morrison can get back.
I don't think he's going to survive it. It has been a terribly hard 2 years. I don't envy any leader that's had the gauntlet. We're going to go through the same thing in Tassie. I think Peter Gutwin. There was a lot of stuff done done in cabinet without other parties being involved. Like they call it a federal cabinet, whatever. But I know that here there was a lot of stuff got done without the other parties being involved because it's a Liberal government. We've had a couple of resignations here. It's looking very close. I don't know whether Jen Butler can do it for Labor here. I'd like to think she can.
It's just worth mentioning that Tasmania is actually right-wing Liberal at
yes,
the moment.
We are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it always was, actually. It has traditionally been a Liberal stronghold, and then we changed to Labor and we went Labor Greens. And then it swung back to Liberal again. A lot of the money in politics in Tasmania is Liberal.
Liberal, of course.
Big farms, big agriculture. Yes.
It's corporate. They may as well call it corporate.
It's all about the money, isn't it? It's interesting because you're so close to the state of Victoria, which is currently Labor, and often, I think it's nearly always Labor, the state of Victoria.
Mm. Well, it was always sort of, because it's sort of like the seat of workers, if you will, it's going to be an interesting run, I think, to see. Dan Andrews may not hold his seat, I don't think, only because it got very unpopular.
He's a Premier of Victoria, yeah.
Yes, so I think we will see spills, and I think, look, is it a good thing? Well, the world's changing, all our trade deals have changed because of COVID, and we're doing stuff now that we would never have done. I'm kind of excited for it in some ways. When you said to me, are you excited? Yeah. I'd like to see the states take their balls back and go, we're going to run independence. We're not going to run any more party politics, and everybody who wants to run, come forward.
Wouldn't it be a beautiful thing if independents had more power and more say, because they're the most sensible of the lot of them?
Well, the only thing you can do, the two-party system is outdated, and I think, just about at the end of its use-by date.
Yes.
So it would be good to see, because the pandemic has brought home the state's independence from the Commonwealth, and they they definitely rule in their own right. So it would be nice to see the states actually ascertain their independence and probably go back and rethink federation. If we're going to do it, this is the time to do it, probably in the next couple of years, because it's such a state of flux, we could get away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've got to go, but I just want to mention that you've picked a song called War Pigs. one of your songs, which you're going to play out at the end of this interview. What's it about?
Well, it's about war pigs.
It's about generals gathering in their masses.
It's about ask Ozzy Osbourne. Yeah, it's a Black Sabbath song
that we've redone, and we actually did it, and we actually had done it for our album called Singles, because we've got a bit. It's a bit harder rock album, this album, and we do quite a good version of those 70s type rock songs, and it's really relevant because it's happening again. And when he wrote it, that was it was against war. It was against, people starting wars, the politicians, they never go to war. They only send everybody else, and they play people, like pawns in chess. So, It's very relevant to now, and the video actually has me wearing a Russian general's uniform. So
I haven't seen that. I will. And just for our listeners, if they want to check out your music, just give us where they can go.
You can go to YouTube/ We Are The Sign, one word, and that'll take you to our channel.
Yeah.
And also that will give them links to everything else, like your own website and that kind of thing.
Yeah, the website is,
thesign.com.
Facebook is We Are The Sign.
Yeah, I think our website has that video on it. So you can just go to our website and you'll find our video under the videos tab.
But we did lots. Because we were in lockdown not playing out, we made 3 or 4 videos last year for the songs. And so, and that was actually released in England on Songs of Freedom for Specialized, which is a teen cancer project in London. And so I do a song. We do a song a year for them.
That's fantastic. What a good thing to do. Yeah. Okay, so very simple web address, thesign.com, which is really where you can get everything. Joe and Paul Volta in Tasmania, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us again. It's always fun.
And yeah, War Pigs is on our website.
Yeah, we just checked. It's definitely there.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. And this is War Pigs.
Yeah.
with 21 correspondents in 7 countries from around the world. This is Bondi Tunes International.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting on FM in Australia and New Zealand and around the globe. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. Hello to Ronan Seagrave. He's our North America correspondent, and he stands by in Winnipeg in Canada. Welcome to the show, Ronan.
Good evening, Henry.
How about this? Today, the 15th of March, 2022, we turn 13 years on the air. I didn't see this coming, Ronan. I didn't realize this was going to last. Isn't it great?
It's been fantastic. I mean, I think I was just, you know, sending you a message. I think I'm year 9. I know I joined in sort of towards the end of 2013 when you put out a Facebook post looking for a Canadian correspondent, and I stuck my hand up saying, yeah, I'm here. I was happy to do it, and it's been a ton of fun ever since.
Have we been conversing before that?
Yes, we were.
I thought so. Well, that all turned out pretty well, didn't it?
It did. It was just a nice alignment. I moved out to Canada in July of that year, and I think your message came out a couple of months later, and I said, well, you know, I'm in Canada. I can give you a perspective of somebody new.
Fantastic.
Settling in the country, you know.
The timing was excellent. Okay, now we are hoping that Thomas Booker in San Antonio, Texas, can join this call. Clearly, he's having some technical problems, so we're just going to forge ahead, and he might jump in at any stage. Lots of serious stuff going on with regard to this war. Kyiv is now surrounded by Russian troops. Ronan, how dangerous is this? And also the fact that they're very close to the border with Poland. What does this mean?
Yes, I mean, the Russians are continuing their strategy of essentially encircling and besieging Ukrainian cities. I mean, we've seen this playing out in Mariupol and Kharkiv, and subjecting those cities to, you know, constant bombardment, both artillery bombardment and also missile and air strikes. And I mean, the situation in Mariupol appears absolutely desperate, Henry. We've got sort of several hundred thousand people with no running water, no electricity, no heating, with very cold temperatures. There was an agreement to set up between the Russians and Ukrainians to set up a kind of a humanitarian corridor, which mercifully today was not attacked and allowed some people to get out of that city. But we were seeing this playbook, you know, play out across Ukraine. It's the same playbook the Russians have done in Grozny and Georgia and with the Syrians in Aleppo. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a playbook of Syria, isn't it? I mean, totally. What they do is they claim that someone else has got nuclear weapons or whatever, chemical stuff, and then they say they've got it, so we have to use it against them. I mean, it's an old ploy, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, they're at it again today, the Russians, and claiming there's any evidence whatsoever, it must be stressed, that the Ukrainians were planning to use biological and chemical weapons. Now, there's absolutely no evidence that Ukrainians have those weapons. I'm pretty 100% sure, Henry, that they haven't. And this is being raised as a, you know, a false flag operation, which would be a pretext for the Russians to use such horrific weapons. The other incident that you referred to was a military training base near the Polish border was attacked yesterday, and that base was being used up until January by NATO training military personnel. They were coming in and just training, providing training assistance and support to the Ukrainians. Now, they got out of there towards the end of January, early February, as the situation was starting to deteriorate. But that's only about sort of 10 to 20 kilometres from the Polish border. I mean, the base, from what we could see from footage that's available, was almost completely destroyed, and you know, the explosions could be heard across the border in Poland. Now, you know, the line from NATO and from Joe Biden is still being held. You know, they do not want in any shape or form any direct engagement with the Russians. That will mean World War III, while keeping the line that every inch of NATO territory will be defended. So if there is any attack by the Russians on NATO territory, that will trigger Article 5, which basically means if any NATO member, any of the 30 members, are attacked, they all are And essentially, Henry would mean World War III.
Yes, and I just want to mention, Ronan, that what a lot of people probably don't realize is that this stuff can happen by mistake. You know, it could happen by mistake that they bomb somewhere, you know, in any of those borders, particularly Poland, of course. And if that happens, won't the Americans and, you know, NATO be forced to put boots on the ground there?
I think the first thing they would do, Henry, is determine whether it was deliberate or a mistake. If it was a mistake, I don't think so. If it was deliberate, yes, that's extremely serious. And it could absolutely provoke a military response by NATO and direct engagement by NATO forces with Russian forces. The other thing that the Ukrainians keep asking for, and you can understand, Henry, why they're asking for it, is air support from NATO to create, you know, stop the Russians from bombing, create, you know, safe skies for the Ukrainians. Now, NATO is not going to do that, Henry, because whatever way you looked at it, you know, NATO aircraft, and particularly American aircraft, could either come into direct engagement with Russian planes or be fired upon from the ground in Ukraine by Russian military. So that's something that NATO is not going to do. Mm. Their continued strategy, Henry, which is really two main planks. One is to provide military support to Ukraine in the form of weapons and munitions and other supplies, and obviously continuing with ever more draconian sanctions. Now, the Russians actually threatened yesterday to attack what they described as convoys or supply lines of weapons coming in, you know, almost exclusively from NATO countries. Now, how that would be viewed, Henry, remains to be seen. I don't think it would be interpreted as a direct attack on NATO if the supplies were attacked within Ukraine. But that strategy is continuing, Henry. We're seeing ever more oligarchs being the noose tightening now around Russian gas and oil. Now, this could be actually very, very serious for Europe in particular, Henry. Not so much for us here in North America, because, you know, we have oil and gas here, just to be frank about it.
Yes.
But, you know, Russia is a major supplier of gas to Europe and to countries like Germany in particular. In fact, one German minister today was warning of absolutely dire consequences for the German economy should, you know, the supply of gas be turned off from Russia.
Yeah, I mean, Russian billionaires, you know, they have been kind of nabbed, haven't they? These oligarchs, I think they're called. Tell me about Chelsea football owner. And he's one of the seven billionaires that have been kind of got. What happens with this football, this soccer team, as we call it, in the UK? What happens now that he's gone? What's the next step with them? Because this is a billion-dollar kind of business, isn't it, Ronan?
Yes, I mean at the moment, Chelsea is in actual danger of going out of business. But what I think is going to happen here is that, you know, they've disqualified Abramovich as a director. I think they will permit a sale on the basis that no monetary value of the sale will go to Roman Abramovich. Now, he's sort of agreed that and written off a debt of something like €2 billion that he was owed out of Chelsea for basically buying players. But what's really being revealed now, Henry, is a rather tawdry tale that and perhaps a conclusion in the UK that Roman Abramovich should never have been allowed to buy Chelsea. Mm-hmm. We know that came from essentially ripping off the Russian people. There's no way you can dress it up, you know.
Yeah.
Buying a company, an oil and gas refineries and companies, and then selling them back at an unbelievably inflated value to the Russian government, and essentially supporting and keeping Vladimir Putin in power. There's nothing good coming out of this, Henry. Mm. And I think it's a warning to the Premier League that there was controversy earlier in the year, Henry, or late last year, when they allowed Saudi Arabia to take over, you know, Newcastle United. And you actually see Saudi Arabian flags at Newcastle United game, including one on Saturday where the Saudis announced they'd executed 81 people. So perhaps, Henry, there's a realisation within English soccer that quite frankly, there need to be better and stronger rules around the type of individuals and people who are running, you know, very big soccer clubs. Yeah. As it really or taint and corrupt the game, to be perfectly frank about it.
Yeah. Okay, if you've just joined us, I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, for Bondi Tunes International. I'm talking with Ronan Seagrave in Winnipeg in Canada. Now, this particular story, a pregnant woman in Mariupol has died. And it's interesting because this story, video footage of this heavily pregnant woman being lifted from a hospital. Well, she was from a maternity hospital, is that right?
The hospital was bombed.
And it was bombed. And then, you know, that made... And it seemed like a good news story. She was saved and her unborn baby seemed to be safe. But then they both died, turning this from a good news story into an absolute tragedy. It's her child died. She actually said, look, kill me if you can save the child. But sadly, they both died.
Yeah, I mean, there's no getting away from this, Henry. I mean, bombing and attacks on facilities such as hospitals are war crimes. We've got to be really, really clear about this. Mm. The Russians have been bombarding and bombing and artillery shelling indiscriminately. And I cannot say whether this was deliberately targeted, but certainly looks that way.
Yeah.
And
I think I just think, Ronan, that they don't really know what they're doing. I think there's a lot of miscommunication going on with the Russian army, who are not really trained properly. I mean, they've never had to do this. A lot of these very young soldiers, they really don't know how to carry this out. I've been, you know, watching the BBC, and someone who seems to know what they're talking about said this, you know, to pick an incident like that pregnant woman is not enough for them to actually go to court on this in terms of what you were saying, you know, war crimes.
No, I mean, it may be that, you know, the collective may be sufficient here in terms of, you know, for example, if the Russians were to use a chemical and biological weapon in Ukraine, that would be absolutely prima facie. But, you know, it could be that in terms of a case to the International Criminal Court, it's a sort of accumulation of different attacks, and we've had reports of attacks in nurseries and other things. You're right, Henry, in terms of the Russian army, and about 40 to 50% of Russian troops are conscripts. We've heard all the stories about, you know, Russian soldiers have been captured by the Ukrainians, saying they didn't even know they were in Ukraine. They're not being fed properly. They've had various issues with their supply lines. Now, the Ukrainians put out a statement today, you know, claiming, you know, very significant loss of life to the Russians, like 12,000 Russian troops killed, you know, very significant numbers of artillery and tanks and aircraft that have been destroyed, that they're claiming have been destroyed by the Ukrainian armed forces. We don't know, Henry, whether this is true or not.
I mean, of course. But
these numbers are extraordinary. You know, they're talking about 1,249 armored vehicles, 389 tanks,
yes,
seven fixed wing aircraft, and 90 helicopters. You know,
yeah, it's crazy. I just want to mention a couple of things here as we record. And of course, things are changing by the minute in that region of the world. Huge explosion recently in Irpin. Two kids were killed. Two children were killed instantly. A school was hit in the past 12 hours as we record. 14,900 protesters in Russia have been arrested. Now, this is interesting, and we're going to talk about that that television broadcast on what's it called?
Channel One, apparently, in Russia.
But it's interesting that people are actually 14,900 protesters. I mean, in that, you know, by the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem like much. But would you dare go out and protest? And what happens to you if you get, because they've been arrested? What happens next to these poor people?
Well, apparently, Henry, they're facing jail sentences of up to 15 years under current Russian laws, such as they are. I think there are a number of things that are happening here. There's that, and that growing slowly. I think we've had a number of generals who apparently have been removed, apparently up to 8 at this point, who have been removed from their positions by Vladimir Putin, as he's unhappy with how things are going. Now, you have that, you have sanctions. Could something happen here in relation to Putin? You couldn't rule it out. The more likely scenario is that he somehow survives, at least for now. But unhappy generals. We're also hearing unending reports from his security services, the FSB, that they're unhappy with how this is going. Obviously, the oligarchs are really unhappy with what's happening right now. And they can see a world where, as long as, you know, Vladimir Putin remains in power, Russia remains a pariah state. Even if this ends, Henry, and we're starting to see some signs of progress between talks between the Ukrainians and the Russians. Now, they broke up today without anything substantive being announced. There are more talks tomorrow. But one is beginning to see, I think, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here, how I think this is going to end. And how I think it's going to end is an initial ceasefire, is a deal and a treaty that Ukraine pledges to be forever neutral. You know, there's never going to be any joining NATO.
Yes.
The Crimea remains permanently part of Russia. And these Russian areas, these sort of separatist areas where Russia is recognizing their sovereignty, they will remain some sort of independent states aligned to Russia. And there is some agreement by Ukraine to demilitarize to some extent. Now, I think those are the basic points around this stopping. The alternative is this grinds on, and what the Russians have been doing in the cities that they've been seizing, and where they're able to get into the center of those cities and besieging, you know, they're capturing the mayors. You know, the mayors are suddenly disappeared.
Yes, twice, I believe. Yes.
Yeah. So you can see how that strategy could play out in Kiev. With, you know, and good luck with capturing the mayor there. The mayor there is a former heavyweight boxing champion of the world.
I just want to get to channel one. The state channel, by the way, is channel one. Now, the woman who, just to paint a picture, if you have not seen this on your television screens, the newsreader on channel one is broadcasting the news, if you can call it that, and then a woman behind her has this kind of poster, which she's just putting in front of the camera, and it says, in English, it would say, "Don't believe the propaganda, they're lying to you." Now, this woman is an editor. Her name is Maria Osinnikova, and she was she's an employee of the channel, probably not anymore. She recorded a message. She recorded a message before going live on screen. Her father is Ukrainian, her mother is Russian. So there you go. She said she was doing Kremlin propaganda. Now, that's interesting. She also, this is the stuff she recorded before she went live on air. She claimed that, you know, the Kremlin poisoned Navalny, the opposition leader, I believe.
Undoubtedly true. Yeah.
And now Maria Osinnikova has disappeared. Go figure, Ronan.
Yeah, I mean, the last we heard was that she was being detained at the TV studio by police, and I guess her whereabouts are currently unknown. I mean, it was an extraordinarily brave thing to do. I mean, as you say, she ran on the set as the news was being read with that banner shouting, "Stop the war, no to war." Mm. It was an extraordinarily brave thing to do. And, you know, there's only so much, Henry, I think the Russians could have been banning social media and trying to stop you know, this type of coverage from foreign sort of TV networks and other sources coming into Russia. But, you know, our world has changed.
Yes.
And, you know, Russians are going to find out about what is happening in Ukraine through other sources. And one just wonders whether this could lead to some kind of larger protest movement. I mean, it really depends, obviously, on the bravery of many Russian people, because we know what happens to those people if they're arrested or detained, such as this lady. But you have to wonder whether a combination of this, a combination of the oligarchs, a combination of the Russians, starts to tighten a noose around Vladimir Putin. And, you know, that remains to be seen. I think if this drags on, Henry, into weeks and even possibly months, the extent of the sanctions on Russia, I mean, first of all, they're in danger of defaulting on debt this week. But there's also a risk of a very major default in June, which could effectively lead to the collapse of the entire economy. And as we all know, you know, that kind of economic chaos can create a very kind of fertile environment on many fronts. The other development today, Henry, was Vladimir Putin looking for assistance from China. So we're said to believe, and this is equipment and other things, which might lend itself to maybe some truth into what the Ukrainians are saying around the amount of Russian assets that they've managed to destroy. That doesn't sound, Henry, like, you know, a well-oiled machine here and a country that has
Ronan, it sounds like desperation. And just on a side note, we're getting reports that 2,100 people have now died in Ukraine. And of course, that is a hugely conservative figure, isn't it, Ronan? We don't really know.
We don't really know how many people have died in, say, Manipur, with the city under siege, or how many people are dying every day in that city.
China are really, you know, trying to say, oh, it's nothing to do with us.
Yes. I mean, I think what the Chinese want is this to stop. There's no question about that. I mean, Putin and Xi had their big meeting at the Winter Olympics. I mean, Xi was about the only world leader who wasn't boycotting the thing. And they pledged, you know, this agreement to have sort of unending cooperation. Now, I suspect, Henry, that Vladimir Putin did not tell Xi at that meeting that he was preparing this invasion of Ukraine, which might lead to some annoyance on behalf of the Chinese. The Chinese do not want to get sucked into this, Henry.
No, of course. And that's all about trade. And by the way, there is talk that Xi, you know, Putin said to Xi, okay, I'm going to do this. And Xi said, well, can you wait till after the Olympics? Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's not of any impact on the sport. Look, I don't think, I mean, the Chinese, could they get involved in brokering some kind of settlement? Maybe. I don't think they will directly. I think, you know, they can apply some pressure on Vladimir Putin to bring this to an end. The main actors internationally involved in peace talks are a combination of the French, the Germans, and the Israelis. These are the Israelis have offered Jerusalem as a potential location for a Putin-Zelensky summit or a meeting, if that were to happen. Their foreign ministers have met, which wasn't, you know, perhaps a particularly good-natured meeting.
You know, would you say that Israel is a bit like a Reykjavik, you know, in the sense that it's sort of a neutral land? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, they've always had to have constructive relationships with Russia because, you know, the amount of sort of emigration from Russian Jews into Israel has been very significant.
Of course.
The last sort of real contact that we know of was at the weekend when Olaf Scholz and the Chancellor of Germany and Emmanuel Macron, the French president, had a phone call with Vladimir Putin, which was described as very frank, which might even suggest raised voices, but despite the urgings of Chancellor Scholz and President Macron, Putin was adamant that he was not going to call a ceasefire and that the war would continue. And Macron and Scholz essentially sort of threatened, you know, ever more sanctions, but also offered to, you know, support peace talks. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. The channel that at the moment between the Ukrainians' delegations and Russian delegations, that's still ongoing. They're going to meet again tomorrow, Henry. There are noises from both parties that things are looking a bit more optimistic. The Ukrainians are saying that the Russians are being a bit more pragmatic about this. No talk of sort of denazification or anything like that. But you know, as I outlined, I think there is a basis of how this, at least in the short term, comes to an end. What the future will be, Henry, we don't know. I think it will be a more dangerous one and a more dangerous world. As long as Putin is in power, that will remain the case. I think military spending by NATO countries will increase significantly, as will troop deployments, particularly in sensitive countries like Poland, like the Baltic states. And until at such a point Vladimir Putin is removed or goes and a new Russian leader comes in, perhaps singing slightly from a different hymn sheet and wanting sort of rapprochement with the West, our world will remain somewhat edgy and quite dangerous for for perhaps quite some time, perhaps a number of years.
Ronan, I believe that your brother is actually in Poland on the border with Ukraine at the moment.
Yes, he is, Henry. I mean, my brother Brian and his wife Rose, they live in San Marcos in Texas, but they flew out to Ukraine. They set up a GoFundMe page to raise about $5,000 US, which they used towards sort of expenses and hiring a truck there, which they've done. They're essentially acting as volunteers at the Ukrainian Polish border, and what they're doing is assisting with refugees and the transport of refugees. And the last day or two, they've actually been transporting refugees from Poland into Germany. I mean, the situation in Poland is of an extreme nature. It's frankly got more refugees than really can handle at this point.
Yeah, I actually just on a side to that, actually not on a side, it's just central to what you're talking about. Warsaw is packed. Poland is full. Refugees have nowhere to sleep. And I've just seen footage again on the BBC of people on the streets and waiting for someone like your brother Brian to help them at least, if not somewhere to sleep, you know?
No, absolutely. The last family, and he's picking up one probably around now, Henry. The last family, they actually took them to Berlin in Germany. Germany agreed to accept them, and they were taken to a refugee reception or assessment centre in Berlin. And I think the family that will be meeting tomorrow will be in a very similar situation. I mean, the photographs that they posted sort of on Facebook of the border was of an incredibly chaotic and crowded situation, as one can understand. It's constant.
I think it's fantastic what your brother Brian is doing. I know he lives in Texas. And himself and his wife, I believe, have gone there to do this. You know, we will try and make contact with him. I realize he's so very busy, but we will try and contact him before we go to air. It's fantastic what they're doing. Do you know how long he's going to be there? Is this open-ended for Brian and his wife?
About 2 weeks. He's planning to travel to Ireland just to see my folks in around 2 weeks. He's looking at just sort of an initial sort of 2 week stint here, and it's a great thing that he was doing. I mean, I have to admit, my brother's a great guy, but I have to admit, I was taken by surprise by this, as you might.
Right, yeah.
I expect, you know, he's living in Texas, and suddenly I hear he's on a plane to Krakow. But you know, wow. It's a testament to him being a great guy, and us Seagraves, we got big hearts, and I think it's just. I'd go there myself if my brother is sort of retired, so he has a bit of time in his hands. Like people like myself, we just have to help in other ways by donating money and doing other things.
Have you contacted him via audio at all since he's arrived?
No, just purely by sort of text and WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger and looking at his Facebook posts. So. Yeah, they're doing fine, and you know, it's incredibly busy. There's an enormous amount of driving, obviously, as you know, drive. I think it's about 6-7 hour drive between Krakow to Berlin, maybe longer. So a lot of driving.
Will he cross the border into Germany?
Yes, will you? Yeah.
Oh, I see. And how do you go about getting permissions and all that sort of thing? I mean, it sounds complicated.
It's not. In fact, the only country that's complicated in Europe is the UK, and that's another story, Henry. Which of course is not in the EU. But the EU has waived all visa requirements for Ukrainian passport holders. So there's no sort of issues at the German border. You know, they don't need visas or paperwork. You know, they're simply and directed to that. You know, a refugee center in Berlin for processing. So, you know, the UK government is now doing a rear guard action, Henry, when they didn't waive the visa requirement. They did waive the requirement for people to turn up in person, which is just frankly ridiculous. And then said, well, they can do it online, assuming that they can. And then we had a sort of a flood of ministers in the UK, starting with Grant Shapps, who used to be my local MP, Henry, where I lived in England. And he looked about 14 and was sort of, you know, Tory MP. But anyway, he said he's going to take a Ukrainian family into his own house. I mean, fair play. him, but the timing was noted by a number of people. It was trying to sort of deflect attention from the Home Secretary, who's a lady called Priti Patel.
Yes.
And she's notorious, I think, at this stage, Henry, for hardline sort of immigration policies. In fact, it's suggested that she actually gave out to the Irish government because of the common border area between Ireland and the UK, that Ireland should not have been waiving visa requirements. And I think the polite response back was that Ireland's a member of the EU. This was a decision made by the Council of Europe. Yes. In the EU. Therefore, Ireland is complying with it and frankly go forth and multiply. Yes. That wasn't a great bit of sympathy.
Okay, well, that's a whole other story, isn't it? Which we must see how that progresses over the weeks to come in terms of Britain and its complex relationship not being part of the EU and all that sort of stuff.
The two prime ministers did meet at the weekend, Henry. That there was an Ireland-England rugby match in Twickenham near London, which Ireland won. But both Boris Johnson and the Irish Prime Minister, the Irish Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, attended. I mean, what the talk and banter was, we don't know. but, you know, Micheál Martin has held a fairly strong line. I think the other thing that Micheál Martin has said in Ireland that is interesting, Henry, and I really wish this would happen, is there needs to be a review of Ireland's neutrality. Ireland is not neutral, Henry, by design. You know, we didn't make some kind of big strategic decision like Finland or Sweden that we're going to be neutral, you know. We've got here by sort of accident and by a policy of, well, we can't be a member of NATO because the British are in it. And I don't think that's good enough, Henry, right now. I'm not suggesting, Henry, that Ireland join NATO. I think that's a massive issue. But at an absolute minimum, this subject ought to be debated in a serious way in Ireland. I noted when Micheál Martin said that, and it was the right thing to say. People started posting pictures on Facebook of, you know, the Irish Taoiseach in military uniforms. It's kind of really silly stuff. And we need to move beyond, in Ireland and Irish, a kind of silly, ridiculous discussions on this and actually have quite a serious one on it.
Yeah, especially in this time.
And decide whether... I don't have an issue, Henry, by the way, if Ireland said, we do want to be like Finland. You know, we are going to be neutral, but it's a strategic choice. And we will fulfil our commitments as members of the European Union and members of the UN.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there's at least looking at NATO, at least have a discussion and a debate about it, you know?
Yeah. Okay, we must leave it there. We're going over time. Ronan Seagrave in Canada, in Winnipeg, thank you for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
It's a pleasure as always, Henry. Take care.
This is Bondi Tunes International at 13 years old today. This is Real Radio.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.